This Janet Mufford Today podcast is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org.
This is Janet Mufford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mufford.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us today. If you read a lot of news stories these days, like I do, you'd probably be inclined to believe that there is a massive decline in Christianity across America. But is that really true? There's new research out, in fact, that actually shows U.S. Christianity is not shrinking, but it is growing stronger. And Glenn Stanton writes about this in a recent piece he did for The Federalist. Glenn is director of Family Formation Studies at Focus on the Family and author of 8 great books, including Loving My LGBT Neighbor. And he joins us now. Glenn, so good to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Janet. How are you?
Doing great. It's wonderful to hear your voice again. And I thought this was such a great piece because I've been inundated. I've read more stories than I can count saying exactly what you mentioned. Massive decline, great crisis, conservative believers up in arms. Why are we hearing all of this?
Well, there's a number of reasons. I mean, one is, first of all, you know, I think that there are secular folks in the mainstream culture who want to just dismiss us and say, oh, forget these people, you know, they're not influential, they're dying in numbers, things like that. But then the other is just simply that these have become a truism. And unfortunately, in the church, you know, that phrase, the church is declining, it often is prefaced with this phrase, as we know, comma, the church is declining. And people just take it as fact, but it is not fact. And the big thing is it depends on what kind of Christianity you're talking about. Now, the mainline churches, I mean, those things, people are leaving those churches like they're on fire. As they continue to, you know, deny the deity of Christ, the reality of hell, the reality of sin, you know, ordaining same-sex active clergy members and supporting abortion rights and those kinds of things, people are checking out of those churches faster than the liberal denominations can even keep track of. But it's the conservative, biblical, evangelical churches that have just been remaining constant since the last 50 years. There has been no dip in the vitality of those churches and the number of people coming to them.
That is really interesting. So you have cited this study that was done, new research. It was published just recently, I guess, late last year by scholars at Harvard and Indiana University in Bloomington. What exactly did they say, for example, about the secularization thesis, which that was, it seemed to be something that they were questioning as part of this study?
Yeah, these are our sociologists of religion folks, and they're both from Harvard and Indiana University of Indiana, as you mentioned. And what they were testing in academic terms, what they called the secularization thesis. And that is that, yes, Europe has increasingly become more secular to where so many of their churches are becoming dance halls and museums and music halls and things like that. They wanted to know, is the same thing happening in the U.S.? And many people say, yes, we're increasingly becoming more secularized. So they wanted to test that and see if it's absolutely true. And what they found out was it is absolutely not true. In fact, they said that our nation, the United States, remains an exceptional outlier and potential counterexample to the secularization thesis.
Wow.
That, no, we are not becoming more secular.
That's interesting. And did they give any reasons for the finding that they had there that America is not following the path of Europe the way so many have claimed? What are the underlying reasons for that? Did they touch upon that?
Well, they really didn't look at the reasons themselves. They're looking at just what are the numbers, what are the data. That's what kind of sociologists do. But I think the answer is, I mean, the thing that they are saying is that the churches that adhere to Scripture as the reliable Word of God, those people who go to church more than once a week, and those people who have regular daily times of prayers, those people are not declining in coming to church. And so what's the reason for that? The reason is they have a vibrant faith.
Right.
You know, they are practicing their faith. God is making a difference in their lives. But it's the more liberal churches that don't believe anything where, surprise, surprise, people, you know, find out that what they're getting there on Sunday mornings, which is nothing, or the opposite of Christianity, all this liberalism in terms of theology and stuff, yeah, people are leaving those churches because they're not getting the authentic thing that they want, and that is biblical Christianity, Christianity that Christ taught.
Well, now, this is interesting to me because you have other information and other studies that presumably these media outlets have been using to put forth this secularization thesis. What of the other research? Are there contradictory studies that have been done that say, no, in fact, they are becoming more like, we are becoming more like Europe?
Well, there are some studies coming from people who want to make that point, you know, that, oh, my goodness, you know, these Christians in voting and things like that, they're declining in effectiveness. But there is a lot of better data from good organizations. And in this article that was in The Federalist, I go on to cite Pew Research, the Pew Research folks, where for the last couple of years they have been reporting this. And in fact, they have said that there are some strains of Christianity that are growing, and they refer to them as evangelical or, you know, the mainline. And so what they are, I'm sorry, not the mainline, the, you know, sort of the real Bible-believing churches. And what they have said, Pew has said, is that the traditionally black churches and non-denominational churches, which are 99.9% all evangelical, the traditional black churches and evangelical non-denominational churches are remaining constant.
Yeah.
And really quite strong over all these years. So it's not just the Harvard research that shows this, but the researchers at Harvard are telling us what Pew and other organizations, Rodney Stark,
yep,
and some of the other researchers down at Baylor who do this research as well, showing the same things. So it's not just a one-off study showing this strength among biblical Christianity, but a number of studies show this, and they've been showing it over the last couple of years, which is really good news.
Yeah, well, this is interesting to me when you cite Pew Research Center and talk about how for the last couple of years they've been reporting on this and talking about some of the strains of Christianity are growing, referring to evangelical churches, Bible-believing churches. The thing that you said earlier about this new study was showing that there is a not a decline, but it didn't sound like they said there was growth. What is the truth on whether or not evangelicalism and Bible-believing Christianity is rising or growing? Is it not growing? Is it staying steady? What are you finding in the research?
Well, that's interesting because the Harvard study, what they show is, you know, since 1970, when they started studying these kinds of things, not just Harvard, but lots of people, they said that generally you see evangelicalism going up and down and up and down and up and down, but what that does is a timeline, they're saying, is a straight bar right across.
Okay.
Level, you know, remaining the same. But Pew has actually said that there's some indications that evangelicalism is growing just a bit.
Hmm.
And I ask people, think about in your own churches, the churches that you go to. Do you see, like, we used to have three services 2 years ago, now we only have one service and there's not many people there? No, the churches that we grow, that we go to, they are growing. And what I say in the article is many of these churches, you go to them and they have multiple services on Sunday morning, sometimes Sunday evening, sometimes Saturday nights to deal with the crowds that they have. The
right.
Mainline churches aren't doing this, but the biblical, good Bible-teaching churches that we go to, no, they're doing quite well and they're quite vibrant.
Well, right. And as you mentioned before, when you talk about the mainline on the decline, a lot of those people are not leaving the mainline and staying home. A lot of those people in the mainline are finding other churches.
That's exactly right. You know, some of the research tells us as well that, and I think this is from Rodney Stark down at Baylor, he says that for every person that the evangelical, for every one person that the evangelical churches are losing from any reason, they're getting five new members from the mainline churches, those people coming over saying, you know what, they're teaching just heretical stuff. We want solid Bible teaching, and so they're going to those churches.
That is interesting. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with Glenn Stanton from Focus on the Family talking about his piece, New Harvard Research Says U.S. Christianity is Not Shrinking, but Growing Stronger. Stay with us on Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Hi, this is Kirk Cameron, and I am honored to be partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to help moms choose life.
Actor Kirk Cameron supports Preborn.
My four oldest children were adopted. That is because of caring and compassionate people who help those young mothers choose life. My wife is an adopted child, and her birth mother chose life for her. If it weren't for those caring individuals that help those young moms value the sacredness of life, I wouldn't have my wife, I wouldn't have my four adopted children, and the two natural-born children that we have wouldn't exist either. My whole family is here because of people that are involved with ministries like Preborn.
Help moms choose life with Preborn. Your gift of $28 provides an abortion-minded mother a potentially life-saving ultrasound. $140 could save five babies. You can give now at 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229 or visit preborn.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you for joining us. It can be really, I think, daunting at times to try to figure out what exactly is going on with American Christianity if you're looking at some of the news stories out there. You might have seen a lot of news stories referencing the fact that Christianity is on a massive decline and conservatives are really upset about it and panicking about it. But now we have this research out from Harvard, and we're talking about it with Glenn Stanton from Focus on the Family, that really kind of corrects some of these ideas that we get from these stories. And this is interesting to me. One of the things that you say, Glenn, is that those who take their faith seriously are becoming a markedly larger proportion of all religious people. What does that mean in broad strokes? What are you talking about there?
Well, and that's really important in terms of politics and stuff. But what it means is if you take the whole bundle of religiously motivated and committed people, as the main lines decline and those people are walking away from the faith, their political or demographic group is shrinking. And so when you take the whole group, then the biblically minded, the faithful Orthodox people, they are now becoming a larger percentage of all the religious people. So the cool thing about that is when you think about the political influence, the cultural influence, the just church, you know, on the street corner, the more you're going to see of that are going to be the more conservative, faithful, biblical teaching and practicing Christians, which is really great news. And it's great news for us in that these people aren't going away. They're actually becoming much stronger in terms of religious influence in the United States.
That's interesting. You know, it's funny to me when we're talking about these media outlets who are sounding the alarm, oh, no, mass massive decline in Christianity. A lot of these media outlets, Glenn, I'm sure you've noticed this, are the same ones who have said those evil evangelicals who voted for Trump. I mean, how in the world can you be a force to be reckoned with politically, but you're experiencing massive decline and you're freaking out, and it's all happening at the same time?
And you know what? I mean, that is exactly it. And I think about this other thing. I mean, this takes us back to some minutia, more granular stuff. But the Roy Moore race in Alabama, I mean, everybody was telling us that, oh, he's such a bad guy, there's these things. And there were concerns there. But then when he didn't win, which was basically because evangelicals chose not to vote for him and stay home, then they counted that as, well, see, these people aren't as influential as we thought they were.
Yeah.
Well, no. They had morals, you know,
right,
in that sense. And so they're trying to twist it every which way they can to say that, oh, yeah, no, religion doesn't have the influence and the power that it once had.
Well, they're really experts at the heads we win, tails you lose scenario. Whatever we say that benefits us is great. And then whatever we don't like that you might have the upper hand on, we're going to put you down. So, you know, either way, they win. They can.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it, Janet.
Spin the scenario a little bit. So politically speaking, and you talk about this in your piece as well, you say this does have important implications for politics. What do you think the implications might be from the research here?
Well, the implications are really that religious conservatives continue to have power and influence. Maybe not as much as we had like in the 80s or early 90s, perhaps, but there's not really a lot of evidence to show that we don't retain that power and influence. And like you said, with President Trump and his election, and the curious thing is, you know, all this stuff, now we don't think, you know, that he's the absolute godsend, you know, a very morally questionable person in many ways, but he is delivering the things that we really care about. And so, yes, evangelicals were able, as I say, to kind of walk and chew gum to see that, yeah, maybe he's not the ideal man himself, but he's committed, for whatever reason, to giving us good judges and defending life and religious freedom and things like that. And you know what? If he's going to give us the policies that we need, we don't have to accept everything about him. But no, we will vote for him and we will support candidates like that. Because that's the other thing, Janet, and you know this, we're a little more shrewder at politics than most people give us credit for. And that influence is, I think, in a good way, not declining necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation. What about the child factor? Because you cover this in your piece, and this is very, very important. As you put it, faithful people grow more children. What about family size and having more babies? How does this play into the whole factor of the decline and or growth of Christianity in the future?
Well, it plays a big, big role. And then the secular demographers, in fact, one of them addressed it as the fundamentalist problem, if you will. What he was saying is, liberals, you need to understand that it's the conservative Christians, it's the Mormons, and it's the Muslims, the fundamentalists, if you will, who are having all the babies. Right. And guess what? Fertility determines what's going to be happening in the world tomorrow. Because guess what? Leaders, political, economic, you know, they start out as babies. Right. And the people that are having the babies are the ones that will dominate what's going to happen tomorrow. And demographers are understanding that. And so Christians, and particularly conservative Christians, being more fertile and home educating their kids well, being more intentional about that, they are setting themselves up well to dominate tomorrow, if you will. What I say in the article, and it's kind of funny, is, Janet, it's like God is saying, oh, no, social Darwinism is right, but just not quite right in the way you think it is. Yes, the fit will dominate tomorrow, and guess what? It's the Christians who live according to my word and obey me that are going to have better lives and have more kids and raise them well.
Right.
And so that's very, very important. And something that the Harvard and the Pew Research says is that the Bible-believing Christians do a much better job of passing on their faith to their children than any other group does.
Wow. Yeah. And that makes a big difference, too, because it increases the likelihood that those babies that we have will grow up to be pretty much like us.
Yep. Yep. And that's a sociological fact. And that goes down back to we in evangelicalism. I mean, it's another false truism that we say is, oh, kids are leaving the faith in droves.
Right.
And they're simply not. They're leaving the mainline churches. But Pew did found some data quite a while ago. They looked at all young adults who had left their faith. Only 11% of those young adults who left the faith said they came from a home with a vibrant, serious kind of faith. The 89% of them said, you know what, we went to church here and there, and yeah, we belong to the Methodist church, but it never really was a big part of our faith. So the issue there is, guess what? Kids don't tend to hang on to what they never had.
True.
But what they do have, they tend to hang on to that. And that's true of Christianity. And so, again, we are retaining our kids pretty well.
Well, 89% is a pretty good return rate, I would say. That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. 100% would be better, but 89 is pretty high.
Yeah.
No, and it's interesting because I'd interviewed a few days ago Jonathan Morrow, this Barna study that's just come out with Impact 360 Institute about Gen Z. And this is the teenagers, today's teenagers. And their conclusion from the new research was that this is the least Christian generation that's coming up. These kids who are still, well, I think it's between the ages of 12 and 17, something like that. Do you know much about those kids, that generation, and how things might shift, or is it really too early to tell?
Well, an interesting distinction there, and this is what Barna is very good about, is what they're getting is not whether they're Christians or not, but whether they're biblically oriented Christians with a good worldview.
Right.
And I mean, we see that in our own churches, and that I kind of see that with my own kids, is like, you should know these things, you know, the Bible stories and stuff like that.
Yep.
A part of that is just the nature of being young and idealistic. But we are not doing as good a job today, and I think it's because there are so many other voices vying for their attention, especially social media, where it is harder for us as parents to really get our kids to learn good theology, to learn the Bible in the way that we would want them to, and that they're being influenced by so many other places. I mean, our grandparents, it would have been, oh my goodness, the radio. They're hearing all this bad stuff through the radio. Well, that was true. And then TV. But now it's like just mushroomed in such a way. So in sense of Barna saying that Generation Z is the least Christian, the numbers in terms of just identifying themselves as Christians has not really changed so much as I see it, but the quality of the Christians, the rigorousness of them as Christians certainly has changed.
Right.
And that's unfortunate. And we've got to do a better job as the church and as parents to teach them well.
We sure do. That's well said. And what about this? Because I thought this was also very significant, Glenn, and in the time we have left, I want to be able to get you to address this. And it's the fact that more Americans attend church now than at the founding of the country. And a lot of people might be shocked to hear that.
Yeah, Rodney Stark presented that information in a book he wrote, What Americans Believe, and he's from Baylor. And he just has a chart going from 1776 through each decade up to the present age, and his numbers of Americans per population attending church, it continues to have gone up since 1776, and it was relatively low at that time. And so, you know, we have this idea that, well, everybody walking around with in the colonies had a Bible under their arm and going to church and talked about God. And yes, it was very godly, but in some ways, we have more people. Well, not in some ways, it's just the fact. We have more people attending and going to church today than they did back then, which is just remarkable. And that flies against that secularization thesis, which proves itself not to be true.
Well, you got to read Glenn's piece. Check out thefederalist.com. Always good to talk to Glenn Stanton from Focus on the Family. Thank you so much, Glenn. Always wonderful to have you here.
Blessings, Janet. Thank you.
All right. God bless you, too. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Well, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas has said that the GOP needs to finish the job when it comes to repealing and replacing Obamacare, and he wants to use one last reconciliation bill to try to do that before the midterms. And the truth is, we need to get rid of it. Obamacare is still having a really negative impact on America. In fact, the Washington Examiner has just reported that the cost of health care for people enrolled in Medicaid under the Obamacare expansion has been rising steadily over time. And the findings from this new analysis show the average monthly costs for people who enrolled under Obamacare's Medicaid expansion rose by an average of 20% from $324 in 2014 to $389 after 2.5 years of being enrolled. We know that Obamacare has been a bad thing, and we want to get rid of it. But in the interim, is there anything that we can do to alleviate the pressure and the higher costs that so many of us have had to face since the advent of Obamacare in terms of our insurance premiums? Yes, there is an alternative, Liberty HealthShare. And joining us now, Dale Bellis, Executive Director of Liberty HealthShare, a national nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry. And so good to welcome you back, Dale. How are you?
Janet, doing wonderfully well, better than I deserve, I'm sure, and it's such a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it is a pleasure to welcome you back. It's kind of interesting how I have seen over these last few years since Obamacare has been the reality in the United States that more and more people I talk to, Dale, are saying, I got to find a way out of this insurance thing because this is killing me. It's so expensive for my family. We're not getting the coverage that we used to get when we go to the doctor's office. Are you getting calls like that over where you are?
We are indeed, and I would agree with you that the Affordable Care Act has exacerbated that case and that condition. But I have to tell you, Janet, there is a primary culprit in our healthcare system nationally that our leaders are not talking about, has not been addressed by Congress. In fact, they've avoided the conversation altogether. And that is the third-party pay system.
Yes.
That means somebody else pays the bill.
Right.
And the ACA just simply doubled down on that third-party pay arrangement where I send my premium to an insurance company, they take care of me, that employer plan takes care of me, the government takes care of me, it's somebody else's money paying for my bills. And healthcare sharing and Liberty HealthShare solves that issue because it's our money at stake now as true consumers on the basis of our faith and our values. We're making choices and decisions that is in the best interest of the care of our health as well as our fellow members.
Fantastic. Well, when you talk about the third-party payer system, I think there's probably nobody listening who's had insurance who doesn't have a story of the horrors of the third-party pay system where you say, all right, I'm looking at my insurance coverage here. It says you covered this. You didn't pay what you said you would pay in the plan, and now I have to get on the phone, and they put you on hold, and you're on hold for an hour, and then they get you on, and you stay on for another hour. This sort of thing drives people nuts. So at Liberty HealthShare, when people choose medical cost sharing, explain how it's different. How does it work? When you have a doctor's visit and you need to pay that bill, what goes on?
Yeah, we out of convenience, we give our members an ID card, but our members explain to the doctor we're self-pay patients. We're responsible for our bill and the care of our cost and our treatment plan, but I'm going to share these costs with my fellow sharing members, so send the bill to this address. The doctor sends it electronically or by mail. We receive it on behalf of the member. It shows up in that member's online account. We call it a share box. And then we crowdfund that expense by other members. Every month, our money goes to pay another member's healthcare bill. And then should ever I have a bill, those same members are there to crowdfund me. We cut those checks directly out to the doctors and the hospitals, because when it's our money at stake, Janet, we have skin in the game. And so we have currently 90,000 cost gatekeepers.
Hmm.
Those 90,000 households review the costs, evaluate the treatment, determine what are duplications and unnecessary care, eliminate it. That's why our cost curve is going down versus the rest of the secular arena that's going up.
That is fantastic. Now, I know many people will wonder, for example, I think sometimes people will cling to their insurance because they say, I know I have this plan that will pay for my catastrophic illness or my catastrophic surgical costs if I, God forbid, got into a car accident and I was in a coma for 3 months, and all these huge payments that people, you know, moan and groan and worry and lose sleep over. What about those catastrophic costs? Can you speak to that issue with medical cost sharing? How does that work if you really do have this huge expensive catastrophic event in your life? And can you be sure that you can pay for that?
It's a fair concern, and it's a great question because it really shows the difference between the guarantees of an insurance contract based upon indemnifying one another and the voluntary participation of men and women on the basis of their faith and values. The core, the glue that holds us together as a healthcare sharing ministry is our belief that we all agree on that says we are here really on earth. God's placed us here on earth to use our time and resources to assist another person whenever they're in need.
Right.
We turn that principle into a solution for healthcare. And when our household members believe in that core value, it's coming out of their shared beliefs and their closely held values and beliefs. That's why we have participation and are able to meet $18 to $20 million of medical bills every month.
Wow, that is huge. Well, what about coverage? This is another question that sometimes will come up. What is covered? What is not covered? How does that work with Liberty HealthShare?
Well, our members make those decisions, Janet. Every year we put out a ballot to our members about some aspect of our sharing program. We call them guidelines that they make adjustments and changes to. But the basic guideline is we're responsible, if we're a family, the first $1,500 in the course of our membership year, we have a heart attack. We'll pay the first $1,500, and that eligible bill is then shared 100% after that AUA up to $1 million.
Wow.
Same would occur if I had a kidney stone the next day or a broken arm the third day. We are responsible that first annual and shared amount, $1,500 for a family. The balance is then shared up to $1 million.
Well, that's really, I think, not something that people will necessarily know, but I'm sure would be very comforted to hear, is that, okay, well, that kind of speaks to this uncertainty, I think, when people go in a new direction and say, well, it's always been insurance, Dale. I don't know if I could adjust to a new system like medical cost sharing, but I imagine of the 90,000 people you're mentioning, they've adjusted just fine.
They've adjusted fine. Those are 90,000 households, 220,000 individuals who participate every month.
Great.
Because they've changed their paradigm. They've changed their mindset, and we've abandoned the insurance model and instead rely on one another in a community of care and support to meet our medical bills together.
Excellent. And as we always try to stress every time we talk, Dale, just for listeners who don't know, you don't have to pay for something that violates your conscience. You're not going to be forced to pay for abortion or abortion-causing drugs. This is something that really, I think, speaks to the heart and soul of a lot of people who say, I just don't want to be forced to pay for something that I'm not comfortable paying for.
Thankfully, we are that safe harbor from our dollars, literally in our current scheme and current insurance world, Janet. Our dollars have been hijacked and used in ways that have violated and does violate our conscience that we would never consent to or volunteer to have done. And yet our insurance dollars are being used in ways that do violate our conscience. And we're a safe harbor, thankfully, from that.
Yeah. As you mentioned before, 90,000 households, the cost gatekeepers, as you called them, who are part of the Liberty HealthShare family and are willing to share those expenses with one another. It's a totally different paradigm, as you've mentioned, Dale, but I think it's just been such a tremendous option for so many Americans who are sick and tired of the third party system. I could go on for hours about how much I have disliked the third party system myself. It really is the case. Well, you got to check them out. LibertyHealthShare.org is the website. You can get more information. And Dale Bellis, Executive Director, joining us. Always great to talk to you, Dale.
Janet, love being with you. Great pleasure. God bless.
You too. Thanks again for being with us. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today after this. Don't go away. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is Ann's story.
I had numerous credit cards and I was struggling with paying them off. I had heard about Trinity, so I made the call. They took care of all of my credit cards and now I am completely debt-free. The people at Trinity are very friendly. They will do whatever you need them to do in order for you to feel better about being in a very difficult place. My name is Anne, and thanks to Trinity, I'm debt-free for keeps.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your account, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. There is hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to save babies' lives through ultrasound. Here's how a nurse describes the power of an ultrasound.
Last week, just one example of a mom who came in was very abortion-minded, and when she saw the picture of her baby on ultrasound and saw that beating heart, it was a defining moment that just broke her. And she said, I just can't allow this baby to be killed, for her own words.
By letting a mother hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time.
I cannot tell you how many times a baby's life is saved through ultrasound. It's just an incredible tool.
Will you help save babies' lives? For $140, you can sponsor free ultrasounds for 5 young women. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229. Or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. A lot of breaking news late yesterday. A closely divided Senate blocked this proposed federal ban on abortions at 20 weeks gestation. This is the mark during the pregnancy at which babies can feel pain. I'm just amazed by this. I guess I'm not totally surprised because it is the U.S. Senate. You have Republicans like Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska going the pro-abortion route. What thinking, feeling human being could vote against anything like this? Saving human lives at the point where that human can feel pain. It's absolutely beyond my imagination. I know this is the reality, but it's just absolutely crazy. This is the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. It failed to earn the 60 votes that were needed to clear a procedural hurdle, as the Washington Post notes, marking a defeat for pro-lifers, but fulfilling a pledge by Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, to hold a vote, the final vote 51-46. 3 Democrats voted with 48 Republicans to advance the measure. Robert P. Casey Jr. of Pennsylvania, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and Joe Manchin of West Virginia. It's just a crying shame, and I do mean crying shame. Even Life News has noted that this legislation was expected to have saved as many as 18,000 unborn babies from abortion each and every year. I don't know. All I can say is that, and I don't say this with any glee, but it gives me comfort to know that no wrong that is done on this earth will be held without judgment. I mean, that's it. And it's true for all of us. We cast our sin on the Lord Jesus. We thank him for being our Savior. It's my prayer that everybody would come to know him and would not just repent of being pro-abortion, but would come to know Jesus Christ. That's what we all want for people. But it just, this kind of wrong is just beyond anything I can really understand. Another big story I'll get to in a minute, but I want to play this cut for you from Joni Ernst because I think this is really worth your listening to. She had some great things to say about these babies and what they're like at 20 weeks gestation. Listen to this cut.
By any measure, at 5 months of development, an unborn child
is a child. At 5 months, babies have grown nails on their fingers and on their toes. Hair has just begun to grow on their heads, and an ultrasound can tell an expectant mother or father whether their baby is a boy or a girl. These babies can detect light, hear sounds, they can swallow, and even experience taste as their taste buds grow and develop. These unborn babies, in all ways, are babies. There is also significant scientific evidence that at 5 months of development, these babies can feel pain.
So sobering. So most of the Democrats are going to have to live with that knowledge, and two Republicans are going to have to live with that knowledge as well. Now, the other big story, it's actually two stories, but they go together. The House Intelligence Committee has now voted to release the memo, that classified memo circulating in Congress that reveals government surveillance abuses. This was announced by California Congressman Adam Schiff, who is the top Democrat on the committee. He was not happy about it. Listen to him.
We had votes today to politicize the intelligence process, to prohibit the FBI and the Department of Justice from expressing their concerns to our committee and to the House, and to selectively release to the public only the majority's distorted memo without the full facts. A very sad day, I think, in the history of this committee. As I said to my committee colleagues during this hearing, sadly, we can fully expect that the President of the United States will not put the national interest over his own personal interest. But it is a sad day indeed when that is also true of our own committee, because today this committee voted to put the President's personal interest, perhaps their own political interest, above the national interest, in denying themselves even the ability to hear from the Department and the FBI. And that is, I think, a deeply regrettable state of affairs. But it does show how, in my view, when you have a deeply flawed person in the Oval Office, that flaw can infect the whole of government. And today, tragically, it infected our committee.
All right. Now, you'll recall that the way this four-page memo was described by GOP lawmakers was shocking and alarming and troubling. We had one congressman describing the details in this memo to KGB activity in Russia. Now, South Carolina GOP Representative Trey Gowdy, as Fox reports, who helped write this memo, said that he wants it made public. And he suggested the memo indeed addresses whether the FBI relied at least in part on the dossier, which was paid for partially by Democrats and the Clinton campaign during the 2016 presidential election, to apply to a secret federal court to get a surveillance warrant purportedly on then Trump advisor Carter Page. And he told Fox, if you want to know whether or not the dossier was used in court proceedings, whether or not it was vetted before it was used, if you're interested in who paid for the dossier, then yes, you'll want the memo to come out. The Democrats have to be shaking in their boots. And I'm sure they have all sorts of tricks up their sleeve, counter arguments and responses and so forth when we finally get the ability to see what's in this thing. Now, Andrew McCabe also has been removed from his post, the top FBI official, deputy director. He's leaving the bureau after months of conflict of interest complaints from Republicans, including President Trump. And a source confirmed to Fox that McCabe is taking terminal leave, effectively taking vacation until he reaches his planned retirement in a matter of weeks. So he's not going to be reporting to work at the FBI anymore. He's a very controversial figure. Republicans have questioned his ties to the Democratic Party. He was the one whose wife ran as a Democrat for a Senate seat in Virginia a couple of years back and got financial help from the group tied to Clinton family ally Terry McAuliffe. You remember all that? And Trump himself tweeted out in December, how can FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, the man in charge, along with leaking James Comey of the phony Hillary Clinton investigation, including her 33,000 illegally deleted emails, be given $700,000 for wife's campaign by Clinton puppets during the investigation? Right. It's a great question. Why is that? Why is that that Andrew McCabe could be in that position? Sarah Sanders said during the press briefing that Trump stands by his previous criticism of Andrew McCabe, but wasn't involved in his departure, didn't make the decision. And Democrats, of course, defended him. Probably one of the most railed against tweets that came out was from Eric Holder, the former attorney general who, as you know, was held in contempt of Congress. He said FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe is and has been a dedicated public servant who has served this country well. I saw one tweet. Somebody responded to Eric Holder and said, yeah, I think the first attorney general in U.S. history who was held in contempt of Congress probably isn't the guy to be making the decision on who's a dedicated public servant who served the country well. Duly noted. Duly noted. He also said bogus attacks on the FBI and DOJ to distract attention from a legitimate criminal inquiry does long-term unnecessary damage to these foundations of our government. Okay. Bob Goodlatte reacted and said McCabe's departure certainly does not mean that we are done rooting out the problems at the FBI. The only way to ensure the FBI remains the premier law enforcement agency in the world is to ensure that the leadership at the Bureau holds the trust of the American people. This change in leadership at the FBI is a good first step in repairing the damage to their reputation. So all sorts of things are going on. I'm just dying to know what's going on behind the scenes. I'm one of those people. I just want to lift that curtain a little bit and see what people are saying and doing and all of the running around like the Keystone Cops behind the scenes. What are they up to? I'm looking forward to it. But I'm glad. You know, it's a horrible thing when you have a big scandal. But if the big scandal results in those who are corrupt and evil being brought to justice, then I am rejoicing because that's what we need. We need more rooting out of evil, more rooting out of corruption in government. And it doesn't even matter to me the party affiliation of the corrupt. I want anybody who's corrupt exposed. I want anybody who's corrupt brought to justice. So I'm hoping and praying that whatever is in here will lead to the wrong people, the evil people who've been involved in any wrongdoing here, losing their jobs, potentially facing prosecution or whatever they determine to be appropriate action. Christopher Wray, last week, the FBI director, said that his chief of staff, James Rubicki, was leaving the Bureau. You remember that? And DOJ officials also told Fox News, as they report, that Dana Bente, the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, who's also the acting head of the DOJ's National Security Division, has been selected to step in as the next general counsel of the FBI. James Baker, who had served as general counsel, was reassigned late last year. Well, they're investigating the FBI, and rightly so. What a disgrace this whole thing has been, and it's bound to get worse before it gets better. This hour, Janet Mefford Today, brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number, 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. Thanks for joining us. God bless you. We'll see you next time right here on Janet Mefford Today.